Welcome to Life in Debt, the Practical Debt Education Program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and a pen for later on in the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week regarding new credit card rules proposed by the Fed. In those situations in which a consumer takes advantage of a temporary promotional rate, card issuers would have to apply the cardholder's payments to any pre-existing higher rate balance before applying it to the lower rate balance. This is the reverse of what they do now. The rules would also prevent banks from increasing the interest rate on an existing balance unless the cardholder makes a payment more than 30 days late, with other limited exceptions. These and other rules sound very beneficial to consumers. During the 90-day public comment period, which ended last week, the Fed received thousands of letters full of credit card horror stories urging them to adopt the changes. Regarding Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Standard & Poor's cut ratings on both of those entities' securities, lowering the ratings on the securities of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is a move that may further complicate those companies' efforts to raise capital, the Wall Street Journal reported. The ratings firm cut ratings on preferred stock and subordinated debt for both companies to A- from AA-, while leaving their senior debt ratings at AAA. Freddie has said that it plans to raise at least $5.5 billion of capital, likely through offerings of common and preferred stock. Fannie raised $7.4 billion through common and preferred offerings in May, but said last week that it may need to raise more capital eventually. And from an article by the Washington Post staff writer Frank Aherns, titled "Indebted Ever After, Scared by National Deficit? You Should Be," filmmakers say, a private equity billionaire, a former federal government official, and a Baltimore newsletter editor have made a documentary film that they hope can do what an endless parade of policy papers has not: persuade Americans that debt has created a looming economic crisis that would make the Great Depression look like a market correction. The movie, IOUSA, debuting August 21st, is an 87-minute alarum on what it calls the tsunami of debt bearing down on the United States' future, caused by the rising national deficit, the trade imbalance, and the pending costs of baby boomers cashing in on entitlements. Early reviewers have dubbed the film an inconvenient truth for the economy, meaning it's not exactly the feel-good movie of late summer 2008. Except for budget wonks in love, it hardly counts as a date movie. The film's thrilling action sequence has a guy going to a refrigerator for a tab. There are no car chases and nothing blows up, except possibly for the entire economic future of the United States. IOUSA offers up as its action hero David M. Walker, a former head of the Government Accountability Office. With movie star looks that scream accountant rather than Terminator, Walker has been the Cassandra, or Chicken Little, of America's growing deficit for some time. Late August, he compared the United States to the final days of ancient Rome, which he said was militarily overextended and fiscally irresponsible. Since 2005, Walker has been traveling the country on the catchy-sounding fiscal wake-up tour, preaching his apocalyptic message to half-empty rooms, at least at the start. The tour picked up steam after Walker's message was featured in 60 Minutes in March 2007. 1 year later, in March of this year, Walker resigned from the GAO so he could be even more vocal on the debt crisis, becoming chief executive of the newly formed Peter G. Peterson Foundation, set up by Peterson, billionaire co-founder of the Blackstone Group, a major private equity player. Their message, you probably know that the national deficit is $9.6 trillion and rising. What you don't know is how bad things really are. If you include all the unfunded entitlement obligations, such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, we are actually in a $53 trillion hole, Walker says. And it will only get deeper as we get older. In an interview, Walker is full of grim one-liners, such as, the debt has increased our risk of being held hostage by foreign lenders, and our situation is serious, and it is deteriorating with the passage of time. And finally, the financial condition of the U.S. is worse than advertised. The nation's debt now accounts for 66% of the gross national product. But unless things change, the film argues that the cost of aging baby boomers will push that proportion to 244% by 2040, twice what it was at the end of World War II, our highest level of national debt. A debt that high, even super investor Warren E. Buffett says in the film, could create real political instability. The film generally skirts specific solutions. It does not recommend one form of Social Security reform over another, but suggests broad entitlement overhaul, tough budget controls, conservation of energy, and at the no-duh level, not buying things you can't afford. In the interview, Walker said that the tax deductions and exemptions will have to be reduced, and a national consumption tax should be considered. Quote, it's inevitable there will be some tax increases on fat cats like myself, Peterson said in an interview, but any idea you're going to solve most of this problem with taxes is not realistic. IO USA made it to Sundance and got a standing ovation. Peterson's foundation, with Walker at the helm, has promised to pay for the movie's distribution. They liked it so much that now they bought it for $2.5 million. The film will debut in 400 theaters around the country on August 21st, followed by a live video town hall meeting from Omaha featuring Walker, Peterson, and Buffett. The next day, the film opens in 10 cities, including Washington, D.C. In other news, a recent analysis of more than 1 million monthly searches conducted online at lawyer.com indicates a sharp 37% increase in the number of consumers seeking help locating bankruptcy attorneys during the second quarter of 2008 in comparison to the same period in 2007. Lawyers.com is the leading online consumer destination for legal information and attorneys nationwide from LexisNexis. In fact, the actual national Chapter 7 consumer bankruptcy filings increased 30.5% in the second quarter of 2008 compared with the same period in 2007. Of course, this is an indicator that consumers are struggling with personal finances and in the current economic climate. The current national trends in rising household debt, skyrocketing gas and food prices, tighter credit, and a depressed housing market provide a revealing look into the preferences and even pain points of U.S. consumers nationwide when they seek a lawyer, said Alan Coppett, legal editor for Lawyers.com. Quote, we can safely say that legal counsel is primarily hired during times of need or crisis, and we conclude that Americans are grappling with today's rocky economic times based on their search behavior. As an interesting aside, the top 10 search topics observed on lawyers.com during a recent three-month period, April 1st, 2008 through June 30th, 2008, are 1. Divorce, 2. Family law, 3. Real estate, 4. Criminal law, 5. Bankruptcy, 6. Immigration, 7. Labor and employment, 8. Child custody, 9. Personal injury, and 10. Wills and probate. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Luktak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. While we're talking about bankruptcy, you can go back to the credit card promises from the credit card company. During the debates over bankruptcy reform, which happened in 2005 that the new law came into being, the credit industry launched a public relations campaign claiming that bankruptcy cost every American family $400 every year. The stat was picked up and repeated as fact by both the politicians and the press. The promise was clear: pass bankruptcy reform and watch the costs of consumer credit fail. Now the numbers are coming in. Did credit industry losses decline? Did the cost of a credit card go down? A new paper, The Effect of Bankruptcy Reform on Credit Card Prices and Industry Profits, assembles pre- and post-BAPCPA data to answer that question, and that is the new law that we're talking about. So the answer is yes. Credit industry losses decreased after the BAPCPA, the new law. The issuers reduced their bad debt and write-offs. That's point one. No. To the second point, the cost of credit card debt did not drop. In fact, post-BAPCPA, the cost of borrowing on a credit card went up. Where did the money go that was saved from cutting back on bad debt losses? That money, of course, ended up in higher profits for credit card companies. The author's conclusion says it all. Quote, although bankruptcy and credit card losses decreased, the cost to consumers of credit card debt actually increased. In other words, 2005 bankruptcy reforms profited credit card companies at consumers' expense. As an aside, according to Elizabeth Warren, professor from Harvard, what happens next? Does anyone hold the companies to account? Do the politicians who said that bankruptcy reform would save money say they went wrong? The advocates of the new law spoke frequently about irresponsible consumers who cost bill-paying customers money. Will the credit card companies now take responsibility for gobbling up the money earned from squeezing families harder? Only time will answer those questions. With the week's news as a current backdrop, we will now look at our situation and visit continuing the control of your situation by creating balance for and by yourself in your own finances. At the onset, I'd like to give credit to Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, for the thoughts, ideas, and examples used from or based on their works, theories, and books. And I recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. At this juncture, I start with a recap of last week's new information, and I also recommend the archives at www.liptaclaw.com/life-and-debt to listen to all the past shows, which are continuing education on the full theme of this program, and much of the knowledge builds on the prior shows. What I was discussing last week was credit cards and the lure of credit card freebies, the gifts, the gimmicks, the different kinds of inducements to get a credit card or to increase your credit card line. These are basically a con. These companies hire professionals to seduce you into getting and using their card to the max. These gimmicks usually are of little value, but even if they are, they are there as an inducement because the credit card company is making huge profits off of its users. And as we noted, credit card profits are increasing every year from $110 billion 2 years ago to $117 billion in 2007. And the goal for us is not to spend our hard-earned cash and just give it to the credit card companies. And it's a really important point, and this bears repeating. We don't want to send our hard-earned cash to the credit card company ever. It is a point of fact. When you use credit card statistics, they show that you will spend much more money if you use a credit card than if you use cash. you will be paying a lot more for the item. So shy away from credit cards and go towards cash. A hybrid intermediate, of course, we discussed was the debit card. And the debit card can be very useful if used properly. But you have to be careful because a debit card is a hybrid and it can be taken as a way to use your cash, but only if you are aware of what cash you have in the bank. I recommend that you use a debit card only in conjunction with an online account to see your activity every day. In fact, immediately when you come home. If not, then like a credit card, you don't know what you are spending from your cash reserve, as you would when you open your wallet and the dollars are going down as you spend them. So it's important that you are aware of that. Otherwise, the debit card just becomes a credit card fog, and that's not good. Another thing that can happen with your debit card is that banks sometimes now are charging fees with debit cards, just like with the credit card. So you only get a debit card from a bank that does not charge a fee. And finally, you do not want a debit card that has associated with it a line of credit. Oftentimes we feel good when people are offering us credit, and that makes us feel a little pumped up and special. But this is just a credit card in disguise, and you will be charged a fee for having that line of credit in most cases. And also, it is a seduction for borrowing, where you now get a credit card component to that line of credit with the debit card. So completely stay away from that. We recommend highly that you pay cash. Cash is very important, particularly if you are struggling to keep control of your money. All the wants category, which we've been discussing, so that money that is your fun money that has a limit point to it, if you want to spend that, you spend it in cash and you are protected, because then you can do with it what you want and you don't have to go through all the gymnastics of record keeping or having a calculator. There's no chance to get into trouble because it's just cash that you're using. Your wallet is your budget reminder for your wants category, and there really is 100% certainty here. You can see ahead of time when to stop, and you get all the advantages of cash. It's easy to tell how much you can spend. There's no need to keep complicated spending records. There's no surprises at the end of the month as with credit cards. There's no damaged credit records. There's no billing mistakes or overcharges, no late fees or over the limit charges, no interest charges. There's no risk of going into debt. If you don't have the cash, you can't buy. Some merchants actually now give a discount when we are using cash. And of course, as long as inflation doesn't reduce the value of the dollar to zero, cash is accepted everywhere. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. So if you're one of these people who cannot use a debit card by checking regularly and making sure that it's not taking on any of the credit card characteristics, and we're recommending cash, new point for you in your mind may be, well, I actually hate carrying cash. I could lose it. I could be mugged. I don't want to show my money when I'm trying to pay for something inexpensive. That is a very typical response to all of this. We will see more about credit card companies, and we have looked a lot at credit card companies, and credit card companies actually are many, many times more likely to rip you off than a mugger in a dark alley. But even with that in the background, is carrying cash really a big deal when you're looking at the amount of cash you're talking about for fun money? If you are earning, let's just say, $30,000 a year, your fun budget would be, your wants budget would be, only about $400 a month, and that means you get about $100 a week for your wants. So now we're talking about carrying $100 a week in your wallet. And if you're worried, you can keep half of it at home and half of it in your wallet. And so $50 in your wallet is not really that much money to be afraid of carrying with you. And of course, when we're talking about other categories that aren't in the wants category for your fun money, it may be important to use your business card or your checking account to pay for those items. But we're talking about everyday run-of-the-mill fun stuff, and that is an area where cash really should reign supreme. It is the cheapest, easiest, most efficient way to make sure that your want spending stays in balance and continues like that every single month. Of course, the next question is, what if I've run out of cash? Remember that before credit cards, which existed in a lot of our lives that time period, people only used cash or checks, and they were able to survive and frankly often survived much better in the savings area than we are now able to survive. So think of that. But even so, you just may want to keep a little extra, perhaps even stuck in your drawer as a safety fund, just in case something goes wrong for small emergencies, like your battery on your watch goes, or you forgot to buy somebody a present, the class pictures for your kids, or somebody shows up at your door, a friend that you didn't expect, and having that $50 in the slush fund there will be handy for you. And of course, on your next payday, you have to replace that money. And another thing you may want to do is actually have an internal savings account rather than a savings account in the bank for your wants category, where rather than putting the money in your wallet, you save it internally to buy something in the wants category that's a little bit more costly. For example, that treat that you've been thinking about for your Christmas fund, for the trip that you want, for an article like a sofa or a television that you want that is a special item. And when you get all of the money saved up, then you can go and purchase that item or go on that trip. The entire idea here is that you need to just keep your want spending in balance, whether you want to spend it in these small amounts or lump it together and then spend it all at once. Another specific thing we have to think about is the food area, because food is both a must-have and a want, and you have to have a little bit of forethought on both of these areas. There is a modest amount of money that we put away for the must-have category, and of course, you often want things in the food category that's fun food, tasty food, convenience food, like that, which is more in the wants category than in the must-have category. And when you shop, it's a little bit challenging to try to segregate these two components out. And the way to deal with that is to take the food money out of your must-have bank account and put that together with your want money and your fun money when you go shopping for food, and then of course pay it all together. So you have to use a little forethought there in determining your eating category and how money is expended there. And also out of the wants category, there is this component of those things that you will be paying for by check, like your cable bill, your cell phone, recreational things that are really wants, they're not must-haves, and you will be paying for those with check. So how do you determine how to put this all together? Well, basically what you do is you take all of your monthly wants money, and that's the first thought or first line, and then you add in your basic food budget, and then you subtract those things that you pay every month for by check, as I said, the cell phone, the gym membership, those long distance bills, the riding lessons, cable TV, those kinds of things. And that will give you the monthly cash that you'll have in your pocket for fun. And the final thing I want to talk about today is what is called emotional spending. And this is really related to spending money because of some emotional component. For example, because you feel guilty, because you need to make up for something, because you need to impress somebody, because you want to fight off feelings of sadness or anger or loneliness or disappointment. That's emotional spending. The truth here is that there are really no magic wands that can be waved to make emotional baggage regarding money disappear. If you have a problem with emotional spending, however, it could be costing you both money and happiness. One component of all of this, particularly in the wants territory, is to ask yourself whether you are really doing what you want or whether some other demons are lurking there in your spending decisions. You don't have to go deep into your psychology to figure this all out, but finding some financial peace really means understanding something about why you spend your wants money the way you do. With this, it's time to take another true and false test. Are you an emotional spender? So we're going to do true or false. I spend money when I get depressed or lonely. When people see me with nice things, they think more highly of me. I spend money to relax and relieve stress. I worry that people may not respect me as much if I don't have nice things. I often pick up the check when I am out with someone so that I look successful or generous. It takes a lot of money to look good. I spend a lot to make my friends and loved ones happy. It takes a lot of money to attract a date. Sometimes I am afraid to say no to spending money on someone I care about. I am sometimes ashamed or embarrassed by how much money I spend. My loved ones expect me to spend a lot of money for gifts at the holidays. And finally, sometimes I spend money on things I don't really want because it is expected of me. So that's an emotional spending test. And the bottom line is if you have marked true for two or more statements, you have some issues regarding emotional spending, and it's time to think deeply about that, and perhaps it is time for a wake-up call. The true responses means that emotions and money are deeply intertwined for you, and of course sorting through it can be very difficult because it may involve heading through some rough emotional terrain. And what you have to do here is create a bright line between your emotions from your decisions about how you spend your money and spending that money in proper perspective. As Dr. Warren says, quote, whatever ails your heart cannot be fixed with money. If you are feeling unhappy, lonely, or insecure, those feelings will linger no matter how much you spend. Spending will change your feelings about your spouse, your parents, your children, or yourself, and it won't make anyone love or respect you anymore. Because remember, difficulties with money will only feed your emotional problems, will only add more stress to your life in the long run. The origin of your problems definitely lie elsewhere, but out-of-control spending will make that emotional problem worse. And I know that, of course, you already knew this, but the hard part is figuring out what to do about it. The perfect or ideal solution, of course, is to solve the emotional problem head on and, of course, keep the money out of it. But this is not a perfect world. You are a work in progress, and you will be for years to come. And next week, we'll look at some practical steps to take your strong emotions out of the middle of your spending. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.